Today's podcast is brought to you by Cypress International, a premier consultancy company providing business development, M&A, and cybersecurity services to its clients as they navigate in the dynamic national security portfolio. This podcast series will focus on what the Navy needs from industry to make tomorrow's carrier wing more effectively support the warfighter in the evolving distributed maritime operations environment. This podcast is a two-part series and includes insights and commentary from Scott Swift, Admiral, U.S. Navy retired, a Cyprus subject matter expert and the former commander, U.S. Pacific Fleet, as well as Bruce Lindsay, Vice Admiral, U.S. Navy retired, a Cyprus subject matter expert and former deputy commander, U.S. Fleet Forces Command, and will be moderated by Jim McCarthy, Cyprus Vice President, Naval Programs, and former Assistant Deputy Chief of Naval Operations, Capabilities, and Resources.
The first question that I'd like you guys to address comes from the fact that naval aviation future is being debated widely on the Hill and in the service. We've got Congress taking shots at F-35 trying to be developed. You know, what I'd like you kind of discuss based on your experience is the why, the how, and the what of building the future air wing and how that's going to fit into the posit combat capability of the Navy going into the next decade and beyond. In particular, I'd like you to kind of talk about the priority of the changes, quantity, capability that the next decade is going to require. So, Bertie, could you take a first shot at that, please?
Sure, Jim. You know, I think it's very important that you start the discussion. Why? Always start with the why. Why do we need the carrier air wing of today and into the future? And I have 4 points on that. First, I would say the air wing is maneuverable over 700 nautical miles a day. Land airfields cannot do that. And since the ocean covers about 70% of the world, that gives us a lot of maneuver space to from which to operate. Second, the carrier air wing is lethal. And it's lethal as it maneuvers. With newer, longer-range weapons that it's getting, it continues to hold targets at risk at greater and greater ranges, and that's key. Third, the carrier air wing is self-sufficient with its own refueling and rearming capabilities and can sustain operations for extended periods of time without taking itself offline. And COVID reaffirmed this oft-overlooked attribute of sustainment. And then finally, the carrier air wing is deployed forward. And so that its presence, and by its mere presence and inherent power projection capabilities, it is deterring adversaries. So I think those four things are the why. Now, the question next is how. How does the air wing contribute to the concept of integrated deterrence that the Secretary of Defense rolled out at the Indo-PACOM change of command recently? And I think the first pathway is readiness. CNO's number one priority, and we see perform to plan or P2P bringing significant readiness improvements to naval carrier aviation. We've gone from less than 50% mission completion rates to over 80% daily. P2P is also being applied to all type model series in the naval, that's the Navy and Marine Corps inventory. So I think, and one thing you have to remember is a readiness increase is a de facto increase in your capacity. And then I think the second pathway requires us to reimagine both qualitative and quantitatively the air wing of the future, where quantitative thinking is centered on increasing capabilities and quantitative thinking is focused on increasing those capacities. So when I say reimagining qualitatively, I'm talking about four key things: speed, stealth, sensing, shooting at range. And this is where quantum computing, autonomy, artificial intelligence, unmanned platforms, all connected maybe by a 5G network, will play a significant role. And then when I say reimagine thinking quantitatively, I'm speaking about how many platforms and must be manned and how many platforms can be unmanned so that for any given budget, the air wing can maximize its combat power persistently. And then finally, the air wing of the future must be agnostic weapon system for the joint force from which to project power to impose cost on the adversary by creating chaos in the observe, orient, decide, act loop. So that finally brings us to the question of what, which is really what you're interested in. What does the air wing of the future look like, both in capability and capacity? First, when I reviewed Naval Aviation's 2025 vision, which was published 5 years ago, my assessment is the air wing of today and the future is on glide slope. What we projected would happen is happening, and the naval aviation is making those changes necessary to secure our future. Second, there's a lot of discussion in the press about divest legacy to invest in innovation and in order to field at scale capabilities of the high-end fight. And third, as I reviewed the Commandant's planning guidance and force design, I see coherence with the Navy's fleet design and the Marine Corps' force design. So for specific capabilities, I see the air wing moving towards the following capability attributes: frequency, diversity, and agility based on new digital and software-driven waveforms, low probability of intercept, low probability of detection attributes to enable passive detect, engage, and kill chains, new emphasis on old things like HF, LF, VLF, and VHF, longer ranges for sensing ISR and for shooting the weapons, larger volumes of fire, whether the numerous distributed platforms are distributed or you have larger arsenal platforms. We need redundant, resilient, and persistent networks, and autonomous and unmanned resupply of critical parts. Those are specific capabilities I see on the horizon. As for capacities, I see MQ-25 is at the top of the list. It's MQ-25 giving mission give today, then it's MQ-25 doing ISR tomorrow, and then finally, network comms relay. You just saw in Breaking Defense 25 June, Air Force Battle Management System, their first buy was to outfit KC-46 with comm relay pods so the F-22 can talk to the F-35. I think you might see possibly unmanned ASW helicopters or platforms to replace the Romeo. We already have MQ-9s and Bravos and Charlies. Why couldn't the ASW helicopter be the next thing? Possibly unmanned loyal wingmen to increase strike capacity at lower costs. The UK and the US Air Force are working on that. Adding smaller unmanned loitering aircraft platforms that are inherently stealthy in order to sense and shoot. We've already demonstrated this capability from an F-18. And the networks have to be improved. So that's just some of the capabilities and capacities that I think the future air wing needs to have, and I think we're moving out.
Admiral Lindsay, thanks. One of the comments you made, though, had divesting legacy to invest in the future, and frequently DOD runs into the buzzsaw that on the Hill, one guy's legacy is another man's critical enabling capability. There's vested interests in industry to sustain legacy sometimes. You know, how do we work with industry to get to those next capabilities that you referred to in terms of reinvestment of legacy dollars?
That's a great question. So I think when you look at that, it's all about imagination. I think what we have to do is not have a failure of imagination on what we could do. We cannot continue to spend lots of money on the next brightest thing. We are one of the most innovative countries in the world. We've got entrepreneurs all over. So that's not our problem. And that's the definition of innovativeness. I think what we need is ingenuity. This is a skill of being clever, imaginative, or creative in the application of new ideas. Think Elon Musk. Think what he did. To drive down cost, he decided, I need to return rocket bodies. And so he perfected the ability to take a rocket body and land it on a platform at sea. That is ingenuity. That is where I think we need to go in order to drive down the costs and get to these platforms of the future.
Admiral Swift, having been the fleet commander out in the Pacific, could you add some context to this discussion? Over.
Thanks for that, Jim. I would like to criticize Admiral Lindsay to mainly having to follow his eloquent outline of how he sees things. So let me tell the audience first up that I can't find anything to quibble about. But let me help provide context, as you suggest, Jim. And that is, I think it's very important that we think, plan, and act in a coherent and thoughtful way. Shaped by my experience in uniform and that the 3 years now since I've been out of uniform, I characterize those three points in the context of thinking strategically, planning operationally, and acting tactically. And what I see is too oftentimes that we think tactically, we plan tactically, and we act tactically, and we don't understand why we can't get out ahead of the competition. And it's a royal we. It's not. It's it's not just the military. It's not just the Navy. It's, you know, not just the fleets. It's industry as well. And I think this is a critical space that Cyprus has demonstrated its ability to bring coherency to those sometimes disparate entities. It's amazing when I talk to industry about thinking strategically, planning operations, and acting tactically, that you see head nods there as well. But this is an environment that is rich, where there's instability and insecurity, there's opportunity. And again, this is space, I think, that Cyprus and certainly its advisors have experience and expertise and a proven track record in. To the point of divesting of legacy platforms, I would suggest that the first point and the strongest points to be made are out of DoD. And I think today, both industry and Congress is well served by leaders at that level, from Secretary of Defense to DepSecDef. She's just been incredible in the time, I think, that she's been there. Both of them taking over very thorny problems of a budget that is contracting at a time that the challenges are expanding. If you look at what the service chiefs have done, General Brown and his comments from an Air Force perspective, the Army chief, certainly Navy CNO, Admiral Gilday, and the Commandant Berger are more familiar with efforts that they've taken. But they recognize the responsibility that they have as service chiefs to manage the challenges that COCOMs, the demand signal of COCOMs, with the budget that they have. And that's where you get this divestiture, this legacy piece. To the question that you posed to Admiral Lindsay on what does this future look like? I go back to this discussion of we need to get rid of carriers. And it's back to the why, how, and what discussion is. What do we hope to achieve by doing that? How will we be better? If things are smaller, the weapons that we face from our competitors out there, specifically DF-21s and 26, you're increasing the kinetic impact by decreasing the size of the vessel that's being targeted by. We started an initiative in the Pacific while I was there. We called it an upgun DSG and recognized that the programs of record, specifically the 53 kilo, the F-35 Bravo, and the V-22 had revolutionized amphibious and expeditionary warfare. And we already had small carriers. You know, we have them in our big deck amphibs, and they're significant capability now. So my question is, back to the strategic piece, what are we trying to fix? And I'm an aviator, so I can speak about this. I don't defend carriers. I don't want to be taught a lesson by a threat that they aren't viable. But this is taking a hard look at these challenges we face from both a science perspective, you know, fact-based research, as Admiral Lindsay pointed out, as well as the subjective piece. What's the art of the possible? You know, that's that trade space that Cyprus is so well known for excellence in. One thing that Bertie didn't mention, and I'll use to close on this point, he did mention MQ-25, but CNO has been criticized for the 60-40 split between unmanned and manned, and it's not realistic. Any service chief has to set challenging goals for its service, and I think that's what he's done. That's what he's done with MQ-25. He's took a measured approach with the capability of that platform to prove that we can operate it in the most complicated environment that it's going to operate in. And that's getting on and off the ship and operating on the flight deck. We understand the threat environments that unmanned aircraft are going to operate much more fully. We've been doing this, you know, for decades, certainly in the Middle East, maybe not as against as sophisticated threats, but we understand that much better. So I think the services are in a good place as they move forward to figure out how best to optimize the forces they have and what are the things that they need to pursue in the future. We might have some discussion about F-35 at some point.
I'd like to revisit the discussion you alluded to in terms of carriers of and the future. I contend that future mix of small and large carriers is probably the right idea, but the small carriers need to be additive. If they aren't, then we decrease the striking power, the overall striking power of the fleet. And frankly, if $13 billion carriers are too expensive, if you build them on 6 or 7 or 8 year centers, they'll be even more expensive. So how do you sustain that constructive combat capability without those big carriers? If you try to do small in lieu of, eventually you run out of that concentrated strike power and the AEW assets that come with it. I find it difficult when people talk about small carriers and big carriers, and they don't talk about how you go from where you are today to where you're going to be. I think that piece is frequently missing. So I'd like you to expound on, you know, what your view of that, you know, that mix question is. Admiral Swift, please.
So I'm reminded by when I was a J3 at Indo-PACOM, I had a retired Marine colonel that worked for me, and I came in with all kinds of airspeed and no vector. And he let me run for a month or two, and he pulled me aside and he said, you know, at this level of warfare, fast is slow. And what he meant was is that we needed to be more thoughtful. And you've underscored that in your framing of the question. So I would expand on that point. I would agree is that I think it makes sense to have a mix of big and small. But having less big doesn't strike me as the way forward. And as I said before, I'm not a defender of carriers. So let me expand on that just a little bit. I suspect that the metrics haven't changed, but when I was a director of Navy staff, we spent some work trying to understand what the demand signal, the unfiltered demand signal was from COCOMs for carriers. And the number was 15. You know, we went back a number of years, and if you look at the request to manage risk as they saw it, COCOMs needed 15 carriers. And that eventually was worked down to a debate between UCOM, CENTCOM, and Indo-PACOM about what the fair share was going to be. And the rub point was the two carriers that CENTCOM felt they needed to manage their risk. And we're going through that now today. Reagan's deployed to CENTCOM as an example of, I don't think we have enough. Certainly if you look at China as the pacing threat, as SecDef has said. So we run the risk of oversimplifying a very complicated problem. That's one point. You mentioned the cost of carriers. I can't help but reminded of the tragedy of the condo collapse in Seaside. And, you know, the facts aren't in yet, you know, as we record this. But one of the data points, whether it's valid or not, it remains to be seen, is that folks were upset about the cost associated with repair. You know, what the risk was this imaginative issue that was out there. So if we think 13, 14, 15 million is too much for a carrier, I'm curious as to what the calculation is if we don't have them, if we're talking about a peer competition. So we need to be more thoughtful about what these solutions are out there. And then you take a look at deterrence. How do you measure deterrence? It's not just the absence of war, but it's carriers are clearly something that not only deter those from taking actions that are counter to the best interest of the United States and democracies around the world, they also are important in increasing the confidence of those that are looking to the United States for support, either direct military support or a support of their own democracies or support for regaining or sustaining stability. This is Prime Minister Abe's free and open Indo-Pacific. You know, that's why Japan is such a strong ally and partner with respect to naval power, to the point of hosting a U.S. carrier in Japan for, you know, as long as I can remember, and certainly would imagine that would continue well into the future. So there is an awful lot of perturbation that occurs with this debate that appears to be financial based. So what are the true costs of these decisions, I think, is the question to ask. And I come back to the discussions that, Jim, you and I have on a regular basis with Admiral Lindsay and many of the other advisors as to how do we make sense out of this to inform both the government side as well as the industry side of investments that need to be made, that predictive analysis of where these decisions are going to go. Clearly, we're not decision makers. but we certainly have insights that I think are useful to both those in government and in industry as well.
Thank you. Evelyn, do you want to add in that?
There's so much good information there that Admiral Swift brought up, especially that what are the true cost of these discussions and issues and everything. First thing, I'm reminded of the UK is back in the carrier strike group game again. They have Queen Elizabeth. Granted, it's not a nuclear power carrier like ours, not the size, but we've embarked 10 Joint Strike Fighters from the Marine Corps along with theirs, so they have about 18. And they've said they're going to take it all the way to the Pacific. We have Carl Vinson going out into the Pacific with the first Joint Strike Fighter of the Carrier Air Wing with 10. And I believe America will be out in the Pacific with her 6. So when you talk about that, you have a mix of the conventional carrier that we have, the nuclear Nimitz and Ford class, and then you have a Queen Elizabeth, and then you have an America class. That is very powerful. And so getting back to your first question about light carriers and all, I'll go to the Commandant's planning guidance. He does not support a new light carrier, but does support LHAs and LHDs as part of those ESGs, and as Admiral Swift talked about, the upgunned ESG. So that we have that capability there. And as I said earlier, you're trying to take what you have, adapt it, and make it better than the single units it was. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there to go ahead with what we have already. The other part is this deterrence. It's an investment that we don't want to go to war. We invested in nuclear SSBNs. And luckily, we have not gone to war. Maybe luck is not the right word, but it's a deterrent, a powerful deterrent. Now, would we say, oh, that costs too much? So think of the aircraft carrier as your deterrent, the nuclear aircraft carrier. We overhauled them for, you know, about $3 billion, okay? And you get a second life out of that. What is the cost over time? And I think the nuclear aircraft carrier is a good investment in deterrence for today and for the foreseeable future.
Thank you, Admiral Lindsay. Appreciate that. I'd like to move now, and it's a nice segue based on your comments, Admiral Lindsay. Where does the Commandant's Force Design 2030 fit into the ACE? How does that fit into TAC air integration and carrier air wings in the future?
Thanks, Jim. First, I continue to see that Tactical Aviation Integration, or TAI as we know it, will remain its current form as the U.S. Marine Corps works to fully integrate with the U.S. Navy at every echelon. And this is per the Commandant's force design. Also, I must note that the U.S. Marine Corps Aviation is the first service to truly integrate its aviation units outside the United States. They are embarked in Queen Elizabeth, and they have their ready room is built to our standards, and they are operating together. So that is very powerful. Not only are the Marine Corps integrated with the U.S. Navy in naval aviation here, they're integrating with our allies. Second, I have to say that the Marine Corps is getting back to its amphibious roots, and in doing so, the Marine Corps Aviation will support the Commandant's planning guidance, which, like I said, states he doesn't support a light carrier, but he does support LHAs as lightning carriers. And they've already proven that they could put a lot of JSF on there. So I think that this means that the Marine Corps might ask the Navy to operate LHAs as a lightning carrier, for lack of a better word, and then use the sea base to reconfigure those LHAs for their expeditionary advanced based operations, such as recon, raid, and seizure, as they start to flesh out that concept. But it's interesting, if you look in the Commandant's Force Design 2030 vision, which was just updated this year, you'll see that the Marine Corps will right-size its aviation, and it's going to probably divest itself of about 2.75 CH-53 squadrons, two MV-22 squadrons, two light attack H-1 squadrons, and their Blackjacks. So that is showing you that they are looking at that amphibiosity aviation, and that is, I think, a key indicator to watch.
Thank you, Admiral Lindsay. Admiral Swift, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, let me, Jim, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back just a little bit further and mention the impact of Queen Elizabeth II's deployment and my concerns. Again, not a carrier advocate, but we just need to be thoughtful about the decisions that we make. One is the fact that there is a U.S. DDG, the Sullivans, that are permanently assigned. And as Admiral Lindsay pointed out, you've got F-35s embarked as well. That carrier strike group has been a magnet for like-minded nations to be drawn to operate with. The most recent example is one of the ships from the Queen Elizabeth strike group, HMS Defender, as well as a Dutch frigate, Everston, just completed operations in the Black Sea, which got an awful lot of interest from Russia, critical interest from Russia, with lots of threats about actions that would be taken. This is the power of using naval power in support of diplomacy. And that's what the secretary has been talking about as well. So I think we need to be careful about what these trades are, and I suspect that it aligns with Admiral Bertie's comments with where the commandant is. 2 points I would make with respect to TAC Air integration. Change for change's sake has little value. I don't think the naval forces have ever been closer than they are today. I think it really got accelerated with the commandant's planning guidance and the commandant's intent that he published, you know, right out of the chocks as he took over. And it's just been accelerated with Admiral Gilday. The 2 points I would make is, one is, look at General Wise's comments during testimony recently about TAC Air integration and how critical it was to maintain the strength of the naval force, whether it's expeditionary or if it's amphibious operations that it's supporting, or if it's strike operations that traditionally come out of carrier strike groups. I would also point the audience towards the USNI FCO West conference that was held virtually, a panel I was honored to moderate. Admiral Weitzel, as Naval Air Forces, was asked this specific question, and you know, with unequivocal response off the top of his head, responded to how important TAC Air integration was to sustaining the strength of naval aviation. So this integration that occurs is beyond just ensuring that there's sufficient quantity of aircraft to support expeditionary strike group and carrier strike group operations. It's the quality of the maintainers, of the air crew, the operators, that entire effort that generates naval aviation striking power. Again, whether it's amphibious, expeditionary, or traditional long-range strike, if naval sea control, as another example, I think from both those comments, both from General Wise and Admiral Weitzel, that TAC Air integration is going to be around for a long time. And I only see that integration getting stronger.
Thanks for those comments. Admiral Swift, you alluded to the 60-40 mix that the CNO has put in place for a manned-unmanned. Could you develop that a little bit in terms of what does that mean to the aviation structure, both manned and unmanned aircraft, and application of carrier strike group capability? And how do we maintain the combat power we've got today in a world where you're doing this manned-unmanned?
So I think Admiral Lindsay brought up a great point about the nexus of innovation and how critical it is to be imaginative in moving forward. You know, I had a conversation earlier where I made the comment that the frontier of imagination is at the tactical edge of operations. I mean, we've seen it throughout the history of the nation, and certainly the history of the military and the Navy. It's, you know, you look at the attack on Pearl Harbor. You know, we were having a raging debate about the primacy of battleships or carrier aviation, and the Japanese helped answer and end that debate. It became carrier aviation because we lost our battleships there. But what really came into primacy was also the fledgling community of submarine warfare. And Nimitz looked around to see what he had when he took over the fleet, and he had submarines, and he sent them forth without a lot of guidance other than to seek Japanese shipping and sink it. And it was those commanding officers, those lieutenant commanders and commanders, at that tactical edge of operations that developed the innovative tactics that became the sustaining force behind submarine operations that continued to develop throughout the Pacific War and is the basis on which the community stands today. One of the members of the panel, the training, manning, and readiness panel that AFSEA USNI West supported, was the commander of Submarine Forces Pacific. And behind him in the video was all those pictures of those commanding officers of those submarines in World War II. So I think this concept of unmanned falls into that, and that's where I see the CNO putting out this guidance of this 60-40 mix. He wants to create the space for his fleet, from E1s all the way up to O10s, to think in the context of moving rapidly forward in this imaginative space, to ensure that we are being as innovative as possible in the integration and embracing of unmanned. Now, I think the question remains of how much saving is going to be had from it. It's a discussion that you and I and Admiral Lindsay have had multiple times, certainly over the last 3 or 4 months. And that is, how do you measure cost? Is if it's more efficient and if it's more effective, it may cost a little more, but what it buys you in projecting power may be significantly more as well. You know, I think this comparison between sixth generation, fifth generation, fourth generation, and third generation fighters falls into that domain. You know, we talk about the cost to sustain platforms. F-35 is kind of in the crosshairs now. But when you look at the mission set that airplane develops, if you look at the amount of data that airplane hoovers up as it operates and provides to a broad spectrum of warfighters, from space operators to air operators to surface operators, subsurface, Army, Air Force. I mean, it's just extraordinary. There is value that comes from that. So this, Jim, you mentioned it before with your background, you know, taking a straight line ruler and saying, this is what the cost was 3 years ago, this is what the cost is today, and suggesting that truth lies on that straight line. I would suggest it isn't. It's much more complicated than just a straight line measurement. And I think that's what the CNO is driving to. He recognized that culture change is hard, which is why he's driving at the need for more openly embracing this imaginative approach. How can we imagine unmanned being integrated into the force, break down to these barriers would suggest that if it's not manned, it's not going to be relevant. That's just not true. I think that's what the CNO is trying to drive at. He's trying to break down those barriers and allow the fleet to be imaginative of what unmanned should be, whether you're talking about Sea Hunter, whether you're talking about MQ-25. You know, the Marines are doing some really innovative things with MQ-9s. We've got Triton out there. There are a number of platforms that are providing value today. The question is, how do we optimize those platforms in what the fleet of the near term is going to be, as well as the future?
Admiral Swift, thanks. That's very insightful. Admiral Lindsay, you want to add anything to that, please?
Yeah, well, when I listen to Admiral Swift, I'm reminded of his phrase, and I think he'll talk more about it, build bridges, not barriers, here. But when I think of DMO and expeditionary advanced-based operations, the three attributes are integrated, distributed, and maneuverable for DMO. And so I see five mission sets that will expand, that unmanned can expand both our capabilities and our capacities. Because as we said, we've got to be able to do both of those with the budgets we're given. So first, commanders, they have a desire for persistence, and that requires refueling. And unmanned, you see MQ-25 moving out. So that's happening. Second, commanders cannot get enough of ISR, and I'm pretty sure that's where you're going to see MQ-25 branch out in the future. Third, in order to mass effects such as fires, you're going to need these comm relays and the ability to probably put independent micro comms networks up that can back up our satellite networks if they fall down. So you see that happening again. I mentioned it earlier with the Air Force's ABMS first buy getting pods on their KC-46s. Fourth, fires platforms. Again, we need to put more munitions and hold the enemy at risk. And then finally, logistics. So again, I think you use all that. You'll see naval aviation with their nice wedge visions. MQ-25 is going to be your tanker, your ISR comms relay. Maybe it could go into ASW. F-35 with F-18 Block 3s today, will that become F-35 and loyal wingmen of tomorrow? Growler, I think, is the most interesting platform because of the electromagnetic spectrum and the way we must manipulate that. Again, as Admiral Swift said, he talked about fourth, fifth, sixth generator fighters. If you look at innovative and new ways of putting them together, I think you can get more capability. And I think that's the thrust for industry to look at. How can I take today's things and package them differently and get a much better capability out of it? And then as we bring on unmanned, does that solve the cost equation so we can get capacity?
This podcast was made possible by Cypress International. Please visit us online at www.cypressintl.com.